It's been pretty busy, and we've only got 7 minutes. Do you think we can wrap up the whole week? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the fifth day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jobs first, the April unemployment report, 253,000 new jobs in this economy. We will talk about that. Jay Powell, the Fed and interest rates, we'll talk about that as well. Some other stuff, too, I am sure. We'll do it with Heather Long. She's at the Washington Post. Kate Davidson is at Bloomberg. Hey, you too.
Hi, Kai.
So, Heather, I want to start with you, and I want to start with the jobs report. Obviously, 253,000 new jobs. The unemployment rate goes down to 3.4%. I want to talk to you about two things. One, wages, and two, the people in this workforce, prime age workers.
Wow. Yeah, it felt like you needed to be playing that Broadway soundtrack Defying Gravity when looking at this report. Not only do we have strong job gains and a number of sectors and that 50-year low unemployment rate, but when you look at and step back a minute, we hit a number of incredible trends. You know, women, the highest prime age labor force participation rate on record. And if looking across, you were speaking about those prime age workers, that 25 to 54-year-old range. It was the highest, I tweeted this out, 83.3%, the highest prime age participation since 2008. So for all those years that you and Kate and I have been writing and talking about how could we ever get back to those days pre-Great Recession, you know, would people come back to work? The answer is yes. When the wages are good, when the jobs are good, people will come back to work. You also mentioned wages, a little bit more of a dicey story there in the sense that, okay, 4.4% in the past year, that's not as strong as inflation, which has been sitting at 5%. So if you're a worker, you're still a little bit teary-eyed. And if you're the Fed, you're still thinking 4.4% wage growth is a little bit hotter than they'd like. That's not consistent with 2% inflation. But you know, it's hard to read too much into 1 month number. That number does jump around a lot. It is certainly lower, trending lower than what we saw at the end of last year.
Okay, so Kate, look, I am no Idina Menzel in Wicked, nor will I sing on this radio program. But what is it going to take for the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes to take hold with this labor market? Because we've had tech layoffs and you name it, and yet we keep on a going.
It's unbelievable. I think they're certainly scratching their heads over there in the Martin Building or the Eccles Building at the Fed, wherever they may be. They are wondering, you know, what is happening? It was really interesting today. We heard from Jim Buller, the president of the St. Louis Fed, and he has repeated an idea that we've heard some other Fed officials suggest, even Jay Powell, that they don't think that they have to see a huge decline in employment, or right, you know, they don't need to see the jobless rate spike very high in order to bring inflation down. But inflation hasn't improved all that much. And we're still adding a lot of jobs. So it's kind of like, you know, what is really happening here? And, you know, Bullard suggested it just might take a very long time for the labor market to soften.
Yeah. So look, so Heather, I want to ask about this, actually, because first of all, do you think the Fed is going to think about now maybe not pausing, right? Coming out of Wednesday, we all said, oh, yeah, they're going to pause. Everything's fine. And then comes this hot labor report, and we all go, ooh, maybe they're not going to pause. Or conceivably, they just hold the federal funds rate at 5 to 5.25% for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think the second choice option you gave seems to be where they're at right now. Obviously, as the Fed chair kept saying on Wednesday, this will be data dependent and things can change. But I think they're trying to signal that they're in wait and see mode. Yeah, it was a strong jobs report. You also saw temporary hiring, one of those early flags for the labor market that fell and is actually down more than 100,000 jobs in the past year have been lost in the temporary sector. So you're starting to see a couple of things here and there. And don't forget, we also this week, in addition to a strong jobs report, we also saw this craziness with with these bank stocks. We all want to think the bank crisis is over, but that still hasn't quite flowed through into a peaceful water. So I think this is really wait and see. And in some ways, it helped them today. If you look at where the market's at, pricing in, instead of pricing in a cut in July, they're now markets pricing in hold for a while.
Right. Right. So, Kate, let's talk about banks, actually. We're going to, you know, Kimberly Adams and there are some other stories coming up. But it is worth pointing out here that that line that Jay Powell thought had been drawn under the most stressful conditions following the rescue of First Republic, you look at PacWest and the rest of it, and that line clearly is it's a little weaker than the Fed chair thought.
The remark didn't age that well, did it, Kat?
I don't think it aged like three hours. Are you kidding me?
It was 2 hours. It was 2 hours later. Now, look, I mean, to be fair, you know, be a little fair to Jay Powell. He said, you know, this might start to draw a line. I mean, clearly that's their hope, that these actions that the government is taking to, you know, first the Fed and FDIC to try to shore up confidence and make it easier for banks to tap the Fed for liquidity. They hoped that that would help. Things were still kind of dicey. They took another bank into receivership. They're hoping that this, that the kind of acute phase of this crisis is over. I think that's the suggestion. But clearly, there's still a lot of volatility. I think investors are just very worried, especially investors in mid-sized banks, about what kind of what's going to happen to these banks. You're also hearing from the Fed that they're definitely going to revisit a lot of the rules and regulations that these banks are facing. So that could be something that's going to weigh on stocks in the future. But I think the immediate concern just has to do with what's happening with them, where investors are going to get wiped out if other banks are at risk. And so they really need to inject some confidence into the situation. And it's a tricky thing to do right now.
Heather, speaking of confidence, consumers are not increasingly. There is talk of recession. There have been tech layoffs. We've all heard the rumblings. I do want to ask you, though, how do you have a recession in an economy where unemployment is at 3.4%?
That certainly doesn't seem mathematically possible. But, you know, we've talked about this a lot on the show, and it continues to be the case that you look at the earnings we've just seen for much of the last few weeks, and CEOs certainly don't sound hugely pessimistic outside of the regional banks that Kate was just speaking about. A lot of CEOs are on the line talking about how they can still continue to raise prices. You still have these really strong car auto sales numbers. So, again, people are saying that they're pessimistic, but what are their actions showing? Right. And certainly for lower income consumers, you can see something different. You can see people trading down to the store brands, people being a lot more hesitant to spend. But for the middle class and a lot of certainly the upper middle class, it doesn't look like doom and gloom.
Right. Kate, change of subject reasonably quickly on the way out here. Big meeting at the White House on Tuesday, I guess, the 9th, whenever that is, right? About the debt limit, the big four in Congress and the president. I want to know from you when the markets are going to start paying attention to the chaos on the debt limit.
I think we're maybe just starting to see some signs, Kai. So we learned this week, you know, the Treasury Department held, a bill auction, 1 month Treasury bills. So those are bills that mature at the beginning of June. The yield on those bills spiked to the highest on record. It was actually the highest of any Treasury bill auction since the year 2000. I was graduating high school. I mean, it feels like a long time ago. That is something. That's not a small thing. Suggest that investors are starting to get nervous, right? That any kind of noticeable distortions in the Treasury yield curve, what we're talking about, suggests that investors are getting worried. And frankly, I think as we've seen in the past, you know, Congress doesn't really start paying attention until markets start paying attention. So we're starting to see that.
Kate Davidson of Bloomberg, Heather Long at the Washington Post on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two.
Thanks. Go buy some T-bills.
Yeah, right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, equities did quite fine. Thanks. The phrase you're looking for is buy the dip. Regional banks, the major indices, up all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, banks, as promised, as the agita in the American banking system continues to work itself out, two words have been getting a whole lot of attention. Bank consolidation. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab told us yesterday that there are more banks in the United States than there are in any other country. She's back today to explain why and what consolidation could mean for the industry and its customers.
The United States is a country of capitalist contradictions. Only four companies make nearly all of our baby formula. Four airlines run most of our flights. But banks? This country has more than 4,000. Richard Grossman is an economics professor at Wesleyan University.
Banking in this country is way more restrictive than in any of the other industrialized countries. We've been super suspicious of the centralization of financial power.
Grossman says at our peak, the U.S. had somewhere around 25,000 banks. That was before the Great Depression. Back then, lenders couldn't operate across state lines, and some states had even stricter laws, which forced companies to get creative.
Banks weren't allowed to have branch offices, but a bank in Illinois that was sort of running out of room bought the right of way under a street so that they could expand their operation.
Community banks were places where small business owners could more easily get a loan, same as today. But David Wyman, an economic historian at Barnard College, says they also carried the same risks.
And those regional banks are obviously prone to the ups and downs of the regional sort of economies, the sectors they tend to specialize in.
When railroad construction dropped off in the late 1890s, so did business at railroad industry banks. If farmers had a tough year, so did their bank. And this is what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank's demise. It mostly served tech startups. In the last 50 years, deregulation has allowed lenders to operate across state lines, making it easier for them to merge when they're in trouble. And here we are, 4,000 banks. Elinda Kiss, who researches financial regulation at the University of Maryland, expects that number to shrink.
Yes, I think we will see more consolidation. I don't have an idea what's the perfect number of banks.
She says no one really knows the magic number between too many banks and too few with too much market power. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
You've heard me say a time or two on this program, I do believe that the stock market is not the economy. The most proximate example being regional banks lately, whose shares, well, have been cratering, shall we say, while bankers all over the country were swearing up and down that things were fine. The American Bankers Association is laying some of the blame for that at the feet of short sellers who've got money on and who try to convince others that share prices are going down so that they can pocket a profit. Yesterday, the ABA asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to look into things, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Short selling, on its own, is perfectly legal. It's just placing a bet that a stock price will go down. And short sellers talk about their bets all the time. On social media, cable TV, in blog posts and articles, sometimes reaching millions of people.
In some cases, that can be really valuable information when a public company is, in fact, overvalued.
Haima Marlier is a partner at the law firm Morrison Forrester. She says what the ABA is worried about is short selling that crosses the line into market manipulation.
What that would look like is someone using social media to cast doubt about the financial health of a public company, and that person doesn't disclose that they have already taken a short position in that stock.
The American Bankers Association says shares in banks that are perfectly sound are getting hammered in the market in a way that just looks weird.
We've been in constant communication with our members, and they've shared with us their concerns, including engagement that they've seen on social media.
Naomi Camper is chief policy officer at the ABA.
And many believe that their shares have been manipulated by short sellers. They're seeing trading in their shares that defy the underlying fundamentals. And they're worried about it.
That affects bank investors, but it can also scare bank customers. And scared customers can go on bank runs. But for now, a lot of this drama is really confined to the stock market. Mallory Newell is a vice president at public polling firm Ipsos.
I think we have to keep in mind that we're talking about a very, very, very small fraction of the public that is actually directly impacted by these various banks going under.
Ipsos polling finds 78% of Americans still trust their bank. So, yeah, Banking stocks are not the whole banking industry, and the stock market is not the economy. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We're like, nope, we're going to take that extra very expensive vacation this year.
Take me with you, please. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 546 today, 1 2/3%, finished at 33,674. The NASDAQ picked up 269 points, about 2 1/4%, 12,235. The S&P 500 climbed 75 points, almost 1 9/10%. 41 and 36. For the week, the Dow down 1 1/4%. The NASDAQ gained almost 1/10%. S&P 500 fell 0.8%. Shares in some of those regional banks that have been taking a beating roared back today. PacWest clawed back almost 82%. Western Alliance regained 49 1/4%. The 1/4% is the important part there after 49. Zions Bank Corporation recovered more than 19% today. Bond prices went down. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.43%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you dig down into table B-1 of today's jobs report, it's at the top of page 30 if you're really motivated, you will see the number of people employed at insurance carriers and related activities went up last month. 15,000 new jobs. There are now just under 3 million people in that industry. That is about 3% more than in the before times. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes explains why.
Forget April showers. This year, there was April hail, March tornadoes, and February flooding. All of that caused a lot of damage, and insurers needed more adjusters to go out into the field to look at it. Insurance industry consultant Jeff Reeder is a partner with Aon.
We're seeing kind of a response to that companies are looking to add employees, particularly around their claim staffing.
Along with bad weather, the past few years gave us what Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Matthew Palazzola calls a heightened perception of risk.
It just grows the need or the perception of the need for the product.
That growing demand for insurance is driving the need for more underwriters. Those are the people who assess how much to charge those who want new policies. There's also a need for more agents and brokers to sell them. And there are potential jobs in insurance for people who understand everything from meteorology to appraising works of art. Noting this, colleges are trying to get more students excited about the idea of insurance as a career.
If we're honest, kids don't grow up wanting to work in the insurance industry.
Finance professor Thomas Barry Stoltz is one of the people behind the new risk management and insurance major at the Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa. He says once students learn about the problems they'll be tackling, they get into it.
It's really about helping others stay out of trouble, and this creates very rewarding career paths.
Also, Barry Stoltz says insurance is a very recession-proof industry. While it may not be as glamorous as, say, tech, it's not having the big headline-grabbing layoffs either. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
be forgiven if you've come to take every piece of news we get about artificial intelligence these days as something out of a bad science fiction novel. Case in point, on Monday, researchers at the University of Texas published a study about AI that can read brain waves and possibly translate private thoughts into published text. I am not making this up. Once ChatGPT was set free last year, we did start seeing comparisons between AI and some other revolutionary technologies, the internet, for instance, or the printing press, if you go way back. And even if that might sound a bit overblown, some people in AI are already making preparations for a world and an economy that looks a whole lot different than the one we're all used to. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Joshua Clymer is a sophomore at Columbia University, majoring in math. He's taking a gap year, but he doesn't think he's going to go back. His mother, Jen, isn't thrilled. When they talked about this at Christmas, it kind of sounded like this.
So, you know, use this, you know, college as a vehicle to get more, you know, and passionate about the things you're doing. And you're saying,
I am passionate. What do you mean, Mom?
But
why
see,
do you think I would work all this,
but I just don't see that you're happy. You're impassioned.
Jen says it'd be different if Josh was pulling a Zuckerberg to launch the next Facebook or something. Josh wants to drop out to work in AI, or more precisely, to prevent the AI apocalypse.
When you tell me things like, you know, I think we have 15 years to live.
So to clarify, I think when I said that to you, I put a probability on it. Like, I think there's a 50% chance that I'm dead in 15 years or something.
Josh works for a nonprofit called the Center for AI Safety. They research your typical AI nightmare scenarios, AI weaponry, the death of truth, that type of thing. Aside from the threat of extinction, Josh believes there's a very high chance that in the next two decades, most jobs are going to be replaced by AI. So he figures, why waste two more years on a diploma?
Get your degree. That's good advice 10 years ago, 5 years ago even. And we're just living in a different world now.
Josh's office mate was a computer science major at Stanford who also left his program because AI was developing so rapidly. Dan Hendricks is the CEO for the Center for AI Safety. He says computer science students are looking at what ChatGPT can already do with programming languages and seeing the coding on the wall.
They've got a lot of the basics down for coding and are, you know, around the level of a late stage undergraduate in coding. And I think as the year goes on, they might be like at the level of a junior coding employee.
Hendricks is in his late 20s. He doesn't think an army of Terminators is coming now or really ever. But he does want to be financially prepared in the event of an AI-enabled armed conflict or other disaster. And there's no Vanguard fund that targets the singularity as a retirement date.
So you don't put anything into a 401k?
No.
Why not?
I think the probability of catastrophic risks on a longer time horizon, I think that's pretty substantial. And I would want that being inaccessible. I would want to be more liquid.
For the AI true believers, the money question is a big one. Do you save as much as you can right now to prepare for widespread unemployment or something worse? Or do you spend more right now because you want to enjoy your income while it lasts?
I'm usually on the more frugal, conservative finance side, right? My whole life's been budgeting and looking forward. And we're like, nope, we're going to take that extra, very expensive vacation this year.
Sharon Kornick used to do CFO-type work for companies, but she thinks going back to work is kind of pointless. Her husband, Anton, agrees. He's an economist at the University of Virginia who researches AI. The Kornicks are funding that extra vacation partly because they're not saving for one very big ticket item in the future.
So many arguments about this. I'm like, our kids aren't going to college. Most people look at us like we're crazy.
Sharon and Anton have two kids, ages 8 and 6. The thought of opening a 529 college savings plan feels absurd to them in a future where they believe AI is going to be smarter than us. To be clear, everyone I talk to who thinks the AI revolution is coming admits there's a chance they're wrong. That includes Josh Clymer, the likely Columbia dropout. But regardless of whether the apocalypse is nigh, both he and his mom agree it doesn't do anyone any good to be so fatalistic.
I feel kind of like, you know, a doctor has given me a diagnosis. If that's true, I don't want to be an ass
exactly.
For the next 10 years.
Exactly.
I want to be able to go back home and give my parents a hug.
Jen says if the robots really are coming, we might as well lean into being human. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we touch on this every now and then, but it bears special mention today. The unemployment rate overall in this economy, 3.4%, as we talked about earlier. The unemployment rate for Black Americans last month, 4.7%. That's the first time ever below 5%. And just for some context here, Black unemployment is usually closer to double the overall number. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context. Used car prices are falling. Saw this in Bloomberg, some data from the used car auction company Manheim that shows prices off 3% in April from a month earlier. And year on year, April was the eighth straight month of annual declines. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.